Now I'm hearing what I'm able to turn source material into. So you now are listening to what's not there, basically. Yeah, it's your mind has to be opened to what something can become rather than what it is.
This is the Last Week Liquid podcast. Welcome back to the Last Week Liquid podcast, the show all about the world of drum and bass. This week, I bring you my discussion with Keane, better known as Zero T. In this episode, we talk about why Keane decided to move from his native Ireland to London 15 years ago, the Dublin drum and bass scene in the 90s and early 2000s, the changing landscape of the nightlife industry in Dublin and London, the importance of traveling and visiting countries with locals, and the importance of living abroad and the life lessons it teaches you, how he got into DJing, the battle between production techniques and actual songwriting in drum and bass, and a lot more. I really enjoyed this chat with Keane. As a lot of you, I massively look up to him as a DJ and producer, and he was really generous with his time. He's really busy, so yeah, really grateful for him to come on this show and share a bit of his knowledge and insights. So I think you guys are really going to enjoy this chat. Quick reminder to join the Facebook group at Last Week Liquid Podcast Community if you haven't yet. Subscribe and rate the podcast on Apple Podcast or Podchaser if you enjoy this content. And if you enjoyed this episode in particular, just send it to one person who hasn't listened to it. That would really mean the world to me and just helps spread the word. But now, onto the episode. So as always, thanks a lot for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy the show. And we're on. Welcome, welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Last Week Liquid podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of sitting down with Keane, better known as Zero T. To most of you out there, this man will need absolutely no introductions. With a career spanning over two decades now, and with releases on the likes of Metalheads, Integral, The North Quarter, and many more, Keane is one of the scene's most accomplished and recognized DJs and producers. You can catch his latest release, Hurt Inside and Sonic Bionic, out now on Dispatch Recordings. Keane, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
Did I pronounce Keane all right? Because I saw you there did. Was some debate on Twitter.
Well, yeah, as the son of an Irish woman, I should hope you know how to pronounce it properly. Yeah. And yeah, you have. So, yeah, no, that was tongue in cheek. But yeah, it's just a thing that keeps happening.
Yeah, I thought Keane was I didn't know it was like that Irish. I thought it would be well spread in the UK as well.
No, it's like, it comes from like ancient Irish mythology. So it's like, you know, if a Greek guy was called Achilles or Zeus or something like that. So even when I was young, like it wasn't a particularly common name.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, in the 20th century, most Irish people would be given Christian names. But my parents decided to go pre-Christian. So, yeah. And, you know, my brother's names are Fionn and Dara. And they have even more issues than I do with people getting their names right. But I thought I'd put out a bit of a little passive aggressive tweet there for the English people who there's one thing getting the pronunciation wrong because the sounds of the Irish language are different to the sounds of English. But so I can understand people saying it like Shan or Cyan or something like that. It's people saying Kieran. I'm like, how are you getting?
Yeah, that's just like making up letters.
You're adding in like extra vowels and consonants where they just aren't there. But yeah, anyway,
to be fair, like there's a lot of like Irish names, like the more traditional Irish names, where from an outside perspective, it's impossible to pronounce. Like My wife is Belgian and she just started working with a company that's based in Galway. So a lot of like Irish people, and every so often she would like text my mom asking, okay, like this name, how should I pronounce it? And she would come back like with a voice text explaining how to pronounce it. Like, I forget what the last one was. Like Sinead or like things that would be written completely different.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of them. Sive's a good one. S-A-D-H-A-B-H, I think. Look, it's I get it. Like my wife's from here, and yeah, I mean, there's, you know, it is pretty difficult. It's a difficult language, and because there's so many letters missing from the alphabet, that the Gaelic alphabet, so you have to make like a W is BH. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, so, that's why. Okay.
Yeah, so you create the sounds from combinations of other letters. And yeah, it can be pretty nebulous and pretty difficult. But yeah, I just didn't think Cian was one of the more difficult ones.
No, I did. Yeah, when I saw your tweet, I was like, okay, interesting. I thought that was like a straight, like Josh or Adam or whatever. Like, it sounds pretty straightforward to me, but okay.
No.
So yeah, probably most people know, but as you mentioned, like where you're based now, you're in the UK. You've been there for like, I think more than 20 years, right? Something like that.
Not quite that long. I moved here in 2006. So, okay, so what's that, 15 years now?
15 years, yeah. How are things in, I think it's London where you're based now.
Yeah.
How are things there?
Well, I mean, obviously the last year has been pretty difficult and horrendous everywhere. The part of London I live in, which is Kilburn, is sort of traditionally, historically, kind of a poorer area. So there's been, it's impacted here a lot. You know, a lot of people would work in frontline jobs in the NHS and in also, you know, just various jobs where they are public facing and weren't able to stop, you know, so public transport and so on. But yeah, generally, I mean, I don't really want to focus too much on the last year because it's an anomaly and everyone's sick of hearing about it. But generally, you know, I do love living in London. It's obviously the reason I moved here in the first place was for the music. You know, I had sort of first releases, first signed to UK labels around 2000 maybe. And, you know, I did it remotely, if you like. You know, I would come over and play some shows and so on. And by the time it got to 2006, I kind of felt I have enough contacts and enough sort of support from important brands and important people in the scene that I could make a shot at making a living out of it, basically, which I did exclusively from 2006 till 2014, when I decided to dip back into the quote unquote real world of jobs.
Yeah. So that's interesting. That's one topic I wanted to dig into, because I was living in Hong Kong for the last 2 years, living in Belgium previously where I grew up, and then moved to Hong Kong for 2 years. And that was like leaving home and family and friends. That was like a big step for me and my wife and setting ourselves abroad. So just from wondering like how much you remember that time when you decided to like leave Ireland, move to London, like, was that a huge step? Was it just across the river, so to speak? Like, how did you feel?
Well, it's a sea, not a river, but yeah. But I mean, look, it's not the same as moving to the other side of the planet to a completely, you know, quote unquote alien culture. You know, maybe Hong Kong's a bit different, but like, it's not that big a deal. It's such a common path for Irish people to take historically. You know, there's massive Irish community and people of Irish descent in England. My brother was also at university here from the sort of mid to late 90s, and he still lives here as well. So for me, it's, you know, it's not a big deal. It's like a 45-minute flight home. You know, yeah, it's really not that big a deal. And also because I had my brother here, but also I had, you know, 5-6 year long friendships and you know, working relationships with a huge range of people in the drum and bass scene. So it didn't feel like I was landing in some foreign place where I was just, oh, I have to start everything again. It's more, I just sort of like, okay, now I can do this full time and properly, and I can go, you know, hang out at Fabio's Club every Wednesday and every recordings night every Thursday and so on and so on. And so for me, you know, it had been something, obviously, you know, getting into drum and bass and jungle in the 90s, it was music from almost exclusively from London and Bristol, I guess. So, you know, it's the the epicenter. It's the mecca of drum and bass. So it kind of, you know, felt like the obvious move. You know, I'd also been DJing in Ireland since I was 18, all around the country, you know, sort of every drum and bass night that existed in Ireland. And, you know, it was sort of like, I've reached the ceiling of that, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
The next step is to jump into the big ocean with all the big boys and see if you can swim. So, it wasn't a big wrench, it's not a big deal. It's not far away. And,
yeah,
you know, as much as Irish people and the English are sort of historical adversaries, look, we have far, far more in common culturally than have differences. So, it really wasn't a big deal. You know, I didn't have to learn another language or any of that stuff. So it wasn't difficult.
Yeah, no, for sure. And so I'm curious, like when you decided to make that move to the UK, and you were saying like you had kind of reached the ceiling in Ireland. What was the like drum and bass scene in like Dublin? I guess that would have been the main spot in Ireland back in those days. Was it like really limited? Like, was it really, what was it like?
Not really. I mean, it was, so in the 90s, like dance music in Ireland was massive. It was the dominant form of any nightlife, really. You know, all kinds, largely sort of techno and house and stuff would have been far more prevalent and more popular, but there was clubs on all the time. And drum and bass, it sort of took a while to take a foothold, but by sort of 96 there was two major promoters getting over big names from the UK every month in the city, and that sort of is what the, if you like, local scene was built around. Bass being one of them. The other one was called Quadraphonic, and they used to do their nights in the U2's hotel nightclub called The Kitchen, which was probably the most, you know, prestigious venue in the city at the time. And they would generally get, you know, Andy C and Goldie and Fabio and Groove Rider, but we'd get Ed Rush and Optical and Fotech and Digital and the list goes on. But we would generally go for the sort of either DJs or the guys we loved or girls we loved to come over, you know what I mean? The guys who were either making or playing the sound that we all really loved. And then the other guys would do the big sort of, you know, more commercial names, if you like, or the more well-known names and stuff. But between the two of them, then by the late 90s, you know, we all sort of were starting to try and make tunes as well ourselves. And, you know, we obviously knew a few people now because we've been having them over as promoters, and, you know, you get to know them and picking them up from the airport, all that sort of stuff. So, once we started making tunes, myself and Beta 2, were really lucky that we just randomly went to see, a Reinforced Records night. So it was actually supposed to be 4Hero and Stretch, but it ended up, the 4Hero had to cancel. So Digital and Stretch came over instead. And we knew Digital a little bit, or Bassbin knew Digital a little bit. Anyway, we just ended up kind of bringing them back to an after party, and Beta 2's girlfriend at the time sort of started, you know, blowing our trumpet proverbially and saying, oh, my boyfriend and his mate are making drum and bass. And, you know, we were like, don't
say that.
You know, don't say that. Like, buddy, shut up. You know, but the guys were really cool. The Reinforced guys were like, all right, we'll come to the hotel tomorrow before we leave at lunchtime and bring us a CD of your tunes.
Oh, wow.
And so we did that. And then a few days later, Mark Mack from 4Hero rang up and signed a couple of them. And then that blossomed into sort of our debut EP, which at the same time, Bassbin's first release was also coming out. And I had a hand in the first sort of five or six Bassbin releases. And yeah, you know how it is if you're a new artist and one of the sort of really respected brands or labels in the scene puts out your first release, suddenly all the other labels are like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And they come calling for music and stuff. So that was a huge slice of good luck and fortune, and really was transformative in the whole thing. But going back to the Dublin sort of Irish scene, so by the sort of turn of the century, sort of 2000, it was really popular and really strong. Like to the point where we combined with a bunch of other promoters who were sort of like-minded in other music. So like guys who did sort of deep Detroit techno, some deep house guys, some like new school breaks guys, and various other things. And we basically took over a venue, like a what used to be a horrible cheesy nightclub in Temple Bar in the center of Dublin, but was lying empty basically for a long time. And I didn't personally, but the guys who ran Bassbin, Rohan being the boss, he, along with the other sort of label heads, if you like, went to this place and were like, look, we can take over this venue every 7 nights a week. And so we did that, and we installed, you know, Mondays was, I think, gay night, Tuesdays was like breakbeat, Wednesdays was hip hop, Thursdays was whatever, like, do you know what I mean? Drum and bass was Fridays, techno was Saturdays, and house was Sundays.
Oh, nice.
And for about 3 years, it was called Switch, was the name of the venue. And for about 3 years, that place was rammed every Friday, pretty much every Friday night, with just us playing, no guests. Very rarely we'd get Fierce or Marky or Bailey or you know, the occasional person over. But generally speaking, it was all just us. And we were able to fill like a 300-400 person venue every Friday for years on end. And then things changed a bit. In the early 2000s, Ireland was the first country in, I think, the world, but definitely in Europe, to bring in a smoking ban.
Okay. I think I read that somewhere, yeah. The impact of smoking
I think it was 2003. And that combined with another thing that happened at the time. So one of the main difficulties with doing nightlife in Ireland is the licensing laws. Mm-hmm. Everything must shut by 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Last orders by 2:30. And bars traditionally sort of 11 to midnight. So that's really just a 3-hour window of time where people, maybe the more casual clubber, not the hardcore music fan, will, you know, go be able to go somewhere else and keep partying for 3 more hours. It's not a lot of time, makes it difficult to convince casual people to come into the clubs. But what happened at that same time as the smoking ban, so early 2000s, was the drinks, the alcohol lobby in Ireland, which is extremely powerful, Guinness and all that, they lobbied the government and basically got the pub laws changed where you can apply for a late license and stay up until 2.
Oh,
so
okay.
Now you've got 30 minutes extra of like bar time till 2:30, which was last orders in a nightclub. You know, why are you going to pay £20 to come into a place to have, what, 2 drinks at
most? No, absolutely. Yeah.
So the combination of those things plus culturally, you know, in the early 2000s, dance music had a little sort of, it wasn't the all dominant thing. You know, guitar music came back into vogue, and rock bands, you know, were suddenly a thing again. The White Stripes and I can't remember the names of them, but, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It suddenly was topping the charts, and guitar sales were suddenly overtaking turntable sales for the first time in a decade. And just generally then, you know, the usual thing, property developers coming in, buying venues, turning them into apartments. So it got down to the point about the time I left, and it's pretty much been that way ever since, that Dublin has like, I think, 1 or 2 nightclubs when it used to have, I don't know,
that's
20,
for
30.
For a European capital, that's crazy.
It's madness. So I have massive respect for any of the guys or girls who are still trying to promote dance music in Dublin and in Ireland in general, because it's just so tough. It's such a tough, the licensing laws make it ridiculously hard in the first place. And then just the absolute lack of venues and stuff. So, you know, I don't want to talk the current scene down in any way. And I don't have firsthand knowledge of it because I've been away for 15 years.
Sure, yeah.
But obviously I go back to play every so often, and the difference between what it was like DJing in Dublin in the sort of late 90s and early 2000s compared to now, there's no comparison. No comparison. I was still yet, like, having traveled the world multiple times and played pretty much everywhere, I've very rarely seen the same level of sort of energy and intensity in a crowd than in Dublin in the late 90s or early 2000s. Whatever reason that is, but just it was really special and really incredible. And all the guys who used to come over to play used to love it. Like we have sort of ended up having Bailey and Flight as unofficial residents. Like they would come over and play a lot. Marky was another we booked him first in 99, I think, before he could speak English even. And
that's crazy.
Yeah, I remember the first time he played was in this kind of a short-lived but legendary Dublin venue called The Funnel, which was the first place I ever DJed, maybe a year before that. And yeah, he came and played on the closing night of the club. So basically it ran on till 4 or 5 in the morning because they can't lose their license. They're shutting down the next day.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And that was just, we were just all, there's some great photos actually of like, there was about 20 DJs maybe in the bass bin crew. And it's literally all of us standing on stage in a semicircle behind him on the decks and just all looking completely astounded. Like, what is this guy doing? Like, it's insane what he's doing. It was just incredible, like incredible energy, just mixing skills, like all the turntablism as well. And just his pure energy and positive vibes, and which he still of course has all of those things to this day. It was brilliant. But it I guess like most things, you know, they can't last forever.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people involved sort of, you know, grew up and had families and moved on to other things. And then the guys who are the younger generation coming through, they would have started coming through right when I was leaving, and now it's definitely a much more difficult thing to put on a night than it used to be, I would say.
It's crazy. I had no idea of all the like history, and especially in Ireland, and it's crazy to think how like popular it was from what you're saying, like in the 90s, and how in demand it was to all the way to where it is now, where there's only 2 clubs. Like that's insane to think about.
It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, you know, in a much less, it's like an extreme version of what's happened in London. Like since I've arrived in London, nearly every venue that I used to play at regularly is gone. Nearly every single one is gone, from big ones to small ones. They're just all been bought up by property developers and turned into some unaffordable apartments or something. But and it is like it's a sort of an epidemic, and it is a terrible thing, because you know, the reason the property developers wanted that building and to be in that area, and the reason that area was cool, say Shoreditch is a good example in London, that area was a very, you know, rough and ready, you know, forgotten about, abandoned, sort of neglected area that was not trendy and not cool and pretty dangerous and so on. And you know, nightclubs and creatives moved in because it was cheap rent and started building culture. And then fast forward 10 years down the line from that, it's suddenly the coolest place in London, if not the world. And all these bankers who work down the road suddenly come in and want to live there and turn it into more of a sanitized banking shithole. So it's I don't know, it's a difficult thing. And it's, I mean, one positive thing from the COVID pandemic could be that night, particularly clubbing, specifically dance music culture in all, you know, festivals and every all forms, contributes a huge amount of money to the British economy, but also is literally one of the few things that this island is the undisputed king of. Like, no one can touch dance music in terms of like impact and importance and the amount of new genres of music and, you know, the whole thing. It is the, like, you know, I know you probably get people saying Berlin or whatever, but, you know, that's one music.
Yeah.
One type of music that Berlin is responsible for or whatever is the mecca of techno. That's London, you've got England, you've got like, you know,
I would jungle, argue like
drum and bass.
Music
dubstep,
in general, I'd argue. Like,
yeah, and absolutely.
If you want to go back to the Beatles, let's talk about the Beatles. I mean, proportion of like the size of the UK and population versus the musical output of all genres is like unparalleled.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's crazy. And it's, you know, the Beatles and Elton John and all these guys, they'll get the support of, you know, the establishment, if you like, here, or the powers that be here. But, you know, when it comes to, they just don't understand it. Like they can't kind of understand it. And it's sort of, they can't see it as like, this is a massively successful world beating industry. British government are always going on about world beating this and world beating that. When none of that is true in the context they're talking about it, yet you've got this thing that actually is undisputably world beating and you've not done anything to support it. Mm-hmm. You're not doing anything to, you know, preserve the thing and cultivate the thing. You're doing the opposite. You're leaving it to rot in the pandemic and previous, and I'm sure will resume after the pandemic. You will also do nothing to protect it in general from, you know, private equity firms coming in and buying up buildings, you know, Fabric closing down. Like that was all an absolute, you know, what was said publicly about that was a complete lie. It was nothing to do with two young guys dying in the venue. They didn't buy the drugs in the venue. They didn't take the drugs in the venue. They just,
died. I didn't know in the venue.
Right. So then the local council's like, we're shutting you down. But the real reason was they want to sell it. They want property developers to come in and buy the site and turn it into apartments or office blocks or whatever. Mm. And, you know, that was the real ulterior motive of that. And thank God it didn't work. But, you know, unfortunately, the level of like security and stuff that Fabric is now forced to impose has, you know, it does, it's not, doesn't feel the same, you know.
Yeah.
It feels like you're in a mini little police state in there, whereas it used to, I mean, the security was always really firm and strong and really good in Fabric from the start. But since that and then the reopening, it's, I mean, you know, it takes longer even for a DJ who's performing on the night to get in there than it does to go through like an airport. Like it's insane.
Crazy. Yeah.
And that's the only way they're allowed to operate because of this kind of, you know, what I would call fabricated, no pun intended, outrage at two young people, unfortunately dying in the venue. But you know, that's just one example, but I don't know, hopefully post COVID, the value of the industry will be sort of taken more seriously by the government and so on. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Not to dwell on negatives too long, but I think it is important to talk about these issues. And I've talked about it in the past on this show, and the UK specifically, it's crazy. Like the importance of music and culture proportionally to other countries, and the disparity between the reaction of the government during the pandemic versus the importance, as you said, of music is like, from like an outside perspective, like makes like zero sense. Like saying people can retrain in as an IT consultant, like the we saw all those pictures. It's like, what are you talking about? It's like,
yeah. I mean, it is. Yeah. Look, let's not talk too much about the political context of Britain in the last 4 years, because that will be the rest of this hour.
Yeah.
and it won't be fun.
No. But maybe looking forward to, like, because things do look optimistic if we look at in the broad sense now with like vaccinations and announcements for this summer. Like, still needs to see exactly how that will materialize, but it's looking optimistic in terms of live events and festivals, etc. What's your like feeling towards like the coming months, and like, is it, do you think there's going to be a rush towards like live events because people need it? Are you cautiously optimistic? How you're feeling?
I mean, look, that's one of the it is undeniable that, you know, the UK is way ahead of anywhere else in Europe in terms of vaccinations. That potentially at least opens a sort of a window back to normality. But I mean, look, personally, I don't know. I mean, I don't rely on music anymore for my main income. So I haven't been affected in the same way that someone who was doing it full time or has only ever done this for 30 years was. So I don't feel the same sort of urgency and pressure to jump back into things. That's not to say I don't miss it terribly. I hate not traveling and, you know, spending a year of writing music that you haven't played to anybody is weird and alien and difficult. But my, you know, I'm still able to, what's the word? Yeah. Like have the optimism and like looking forward to the, to when it comes back and when it comes back fully with no social distancing and any of that stuff, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be incredible. Every club, every festival, everything is just going to be, the energy and the release of people is going to be something to behold and something really special. And hopefully that can be harnessed in some positive ways to maybe change how the music industry is operated here or everywhere, basically. Yeah. But particularly here, you know, I don't want to get too excited because I personally think that the dates they've said won't really be able, they might not be able to keep to them in terms of June. Well, the June 21st, apparently everything's on again, but
that sounds very soon.
That does sound very soon. I mean, the thing is, you know, I think within the next few months, I think it's by September that every adult in the UK is supposed to have been vaccinated. But you know, that's not counting variants and all that sort of stuff. And who knows, but, yeah, I mean, generally, look, my reason for living is playing music to people, whether it's my own or other people's. And, you know, I'll never not want to do that. I'll never not be hungry for that feeling there, because it's very, very few feelings that can top, you know, making a whole room go nuts. You know what I mean? So it's... Yeah, I am desperate for it, and particularly the traveling. Like I was about to literally in the airport, checked in, about to step on a plane to Colombia in March last year, and my agent called and was like, don't get on the plane.
Oh, that's crazy.
Because when you get there, you'll get quarantined for 2 weeks at your own expense and the show won't be happening and so on. And that was heartbreaking because South America is the only place I haven't been to.
Tell me about that. What was it, a festival or like
It was a sort of a reggae and drum and bass festival in Bogota, and it was myself, Nympho, Kyrist and General Levy, you know who he is, who's a MC. He made like a big classic crossover jungle hit in the 90s that sort of got in the charts over here and stuff. So yeah, it was the four of us traveling, and I presume they had other people coming in from other parts of the world as well. And yeah, we just were like, oh god, you know, so desperate to go, but you know, I'm glad I didn't, because I would have just spent 2 weeks in a Colombian hotel and then come straight back, which would have been, I think, even worse than not playing it at all.
That was a great job from your promoter or a manager,
the agent,
to warn
your agent.
Yeah,
it was a good catch, all right. I mean, you know, it was right at that time when it was like, you know, places were starting to shut down and borders were starting to close and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, it was heartbreaking, though, I have to say. It was really heartbreaking.
Yeah,
I've been
trying
to get to South America for 20 years, and that was, I was in the airport and I had to turn around. So hopefully that can happen again.
It's interesting. From like, I would have always imagined that as a DJ touring the world, or even like a just businessman like traveling the world, like travel would be like one of the most like stressful and one of the big constraints of the job, like constantly being on flights and moving around. And but from what you're saying, it's like the part you enjoy most. I find that interesting.
Let me clarify that.
Okay.
I hate airports. I hate traveling. I certainly don't like not sleeping and all that. I mean, I hate the actual act of having to get to the other place.
Okay. Yeah.
It's being in the other place that I love, you know, and tasting all the cultures of the world. And you know, one of the great things about traveling in this way, where you're not actually a tourist, you're actually working somewhere, is you're always with local people. You're never a tourist. You're always with the local people, you know, the promoters, and you get a completely different experience of a place than you would if you just booked a flight and booked a hotel and just went over there on your own and or whatever on a holiday and tried to just check the place out, you know. And that gives you a completely different appreciation of anywhere, really, because obviously they'll know what is worth seeing, what isn't worth seeing, you know.
Yeah, it's completely different. Yeah.
All that stuff. And they can actually tell you stuff and teach you about their culture and about their place. So that's what I miss, really. And I've not been in one place this long. I can't honestly, probably ever in my life. Yeah, I mean, I traveled all through my childhood with my father's job a lot. So traveling was just regularly was sort of always just part of my life experience. Yeah. From as far as I can remember back, like I was in Iraq when I was three. You know, like I was in Israel and Lebanon, or was it? Yeah. When I was six, and Malaysia when I was 10, China when I was 12, all these different places. So for me and my dad, you know, continues to, but spent his whole life traveling around the world doing his thing. So for me, it felt, yeah, it's like this is natural, and this is what you should do if you're lucky enough to get to do it, basically.
Yeah. Do you remember any destination, like country, city, where, not that you didn't have any expectation of it, but where you didn't think much of it and it really surprised you when you got there, like made a strong impact on you? Or
I certainly does not anywhere that I can think of in the world that I would not be interested in going and seeing. And I certainly wouldn't have a prejudgment of a place. What I learned from a young age from traveling, especially to some places that were turbulent, to say the least, you know, I was in Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war in the early 80s. You know, I think we were there for almost a month, and you know, in an active war zone, essentially. Yeah. And I've been other places. I was in Japan I landed in Japan on the day of the Fukushima disaster. So I sort of was in Tokyo when that earthquake hit, in my hotel, like shaking around and stuff. So I've had a few experiences of being in places that I guess maybe people would be traditionally scared of. Mm-hmm. or yeah, I guess to sum it up, what I've learned is if your knowledge of a place is what you've consumed from the media, you're only going to know about all of the worst aspects of it and all of the most dangerous and extreme things that happened and all that. So you're going to have a certain impression of it. I gave you a good example, Russia, right? Mm-hmm. So Russia, you know, in a lot of the world has a certain reputation. And, you know, a lot of people were like, I wouldn't go there. And you know, my experience of it was there is some scary aspects to Russia, Moscow particularly.
Yeah.
But you know, generally speaking, I personally was never in any danger, and obviously I'm with local crew and they all know what's what. So I don't know. I just always found that you should only judge a place by talking to somebody who lives there and who knows it really well, never by what you read in a newspaper or some catastrophe that happened or some horrible stuff that's going on, because that's not going to be representative of day-to-day life in that place.
And not the people.
Yeah.
Speaking on Russia specifically, like when you think of Russia, you think of Russian government, like you think of Putin and all of that, but that's not Russia. There's people. And a lot of Russians probably don't agree with the politics of Russia. And so I see what you mean of like just having an opinion on a country based on what you see in the news. It doesn't make much sense.
Well, you know, you could say exactly the same thing about Britain.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, if you judge Britain by its leadership and its political decision making, well, ever, but definitely in the last 5 years, you would not think very well. I certainly would not think very highly of the place. But, you know, a nation isn't its government and isn't its sort of, you know, geopolitical activity. It's the people. that make up the place. And one thing I have learned from traveling the world is every culture, we're all the same. Like everybody is essentially the same. Everybody laughs, everybody cries, everybody shits, everybody bleeds, everybody dies, you know. Yeah. All the same, like most things are universal. All the nuances and differences are recent, as in, you know, they're human civilization, cultural, you know, idiosyncrasies, but they're not. Ultimately, we're all the same animal. We all have the same motivations, and yeah, we all love the same things. And, you know, even when you don't have a language, you can't share languages with someone, you can communicate with them. You can easily, you know, bond with somebody through common things, you know. Music is a great one.
Drone bass.
Music, food, you know, all these things are universal, and it's easy. I think it's easy to find common ground with anybody, really.
Yeah, I love that. That's really inspiring. Yeah, it's definitely something I found, like, living in Hong Kong, traveling around the world, we often have a lot more in common than we think. Definitely feel a lot of people could learn a thing or two from what you just said there, but
yeah, it's the best education in the world, really, traveling. And my opinion, like, traveling is there is no better way to learn about sort of humanity and yourself and the world in general than traveling and experiencing it and making that realization. You know, you go to the places and you're told, or you're fed all this difference, you're fed all this information about how different it is and how it's not as good as this, and it's, you know, or such and such. And, you know, you get there and you're like, everyone's the same. Like, everyone has the same motivations. Do you know what I mean? Everyone loves their parents and, you know, wants the best for their family. And, you know, all that's, it's just all the same stuff. Like, you know, we're all motivated by love and fear and all the same sort of inputs. So, and for me, I think traveling as a really small child, and especially being in places where you are the visible minority, so like China or the Middle East, and it's a place where you stick out like a sore thumb, and, you know, you'll have little kids looking at you like you're an alien and pointing fingers and, you know, all of that stuff. Like, that experience is really important and it's vital, and that should be, you know, in a perfect world, I would send every child to the opposite side of the world to have that experience. Because when it comes back on the other way around, you will suddenly understand it and have empathy with it. And you won't do the opposite, basically. You won't do the same thing to another person who's a visible minority in your community. So I think that for me is one of the best things about traveling, is just like, just to, you know, universality, but also getting to maybe experience some of the things that other people will experience in your homeland. And it just gives you a natural way to empathize, basically.
It gives you a perspective you'd never have otherwise. Like, it's impossible to, it's like learning a language, or like, the best thing is always to move to the country, live there, and just soak in the culture, and you get another perspective you wouldn't get otherwise.
Sure.
I'm curious, this might be a stretch, but like, did your interest in, like, music and different types of music and all of that spark from, like, traveling across the world, experiencing different cultures, or is that too much of a stretch?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, the main reason I would say for my love of music is from my parents, more specifically my dad. My mom plays piano and stuff, but my dad's was a big collector of jazz and classical music, and they lived in the 70s. They lived in America in the mid 70s for a couple of years, and one of my brothers was actually born there, and, you know, they would go and see the jazz greats, and he has a big, amazing jazz vinyl collection, which I've now sort of inherited, even though he's still alive. I commandeered it, under the promise that I'll digitize it all, and I think I've done about 10% of it in the last 20 years, so which he gives me a hard time about all the time. But yeah, it was really being in a household that was, it wasn't just music, it was just like all of creative arts was like a huge, both my parents are doctors, but they're both very into the arts in general, and you know, we were constantly dragged around art galleries and taken to music. And my, you know, my dad played guitar and sang in a folk band, and my mom played piano, and it, you know, and there was just always music in the house. One of my older brothers, then he's a talented musician. He started playing guitar, then switched to drums. And it was just sort of like, it was just like they pumped culture into us from birth, basically. Yeah. So it's not a surprise that I think all three of us are in creative jobs basically now. So
do you remember when you were a kid, like those art galleries and musicals, whatever, do you remember like enjoying it? Because as a kid,
no,
like going to a museum, it's okay.
It was like torture. It was absolutely like, oh god, another museum, like really. You know, of course, like no kid wants to be dragged around a museum for 3 hours and all that, but I'm so glad they did, like, because you know, you can't replace that, and you know, it is absolutely fundamental to the person I am today. So yeah, definitely doing kids, you're doing stuff that's good for your kids that they don't like is necessary and important.
Yeah, I've talked about it in the past that I learned piano when I was a kid, and there were definitely phases where I really didn't enjoy it, like going to classes and practicing at home and scales and all of that. And when I look back on it now, it enabled me so much different things, like picking up the guitar really easily and having basic knowledge of theory and producing music. All of that wouldn't be possible if they didn't force me to some extent to stick with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was the same. Like my mum had, all of us had piano lessons, and I did, I think was it preliminary grades, like, you know, when I was about 7 or 8 or something before grade one, whatever those preliminary ones, I think there's 2 preliminary ones, which I did. And I sort of got to about 10 years old. And yeah, like you say, it just felt like this is just more boring crap I have to learn. And, you know, scales aren't fun. And what I do wish is that I'd been taught how to play the piano by a jazz pianist. Mm. That would have been good. And learned to play stuff that sounded cool, rather than learn how to play Moonlight Sonata or Fourierlise or something like that, you know. And much to my own self-loathing, I quit, you know, at about 10. I was just like, I'm not doing this anymore. And you know, I was getting into other things, sports and stuff. So I stopped, and I really wish I hadn't, because I would love to be able to play properly. Like, I can play chords and stuff, but I would love to be able to perform live, play a full song on the piano, and read music properly and all that sort of stuff, which I cannot do. So
it's never too late.
Yeah, it's not. But yeah, I mean, learning something when you're my age and learning something when you're 7
for sure,
different.
So do you remember when you actually started like picking up records and being interested in actually like DJing? Was that like a straight line from piano and music, or was there a gap?
Not really, no. You know, but I've sort of, my brothers are like 5 and 7 years older than me. So when I would have been, you know, sort of 10, they were like 15 and 17. So that's like perfect age to, you know, they were heavily into music of various kinds. And well, it changed over time, you know, sort of remember being very young and then being seriously into heavy metal, like Iron Maiden and all that stuff. Yeah. And then that developed into like The Cure and The Smiths all that stuff. And then that developed into like early grunge and stuff like that. And so on. And then, yeah, my brother, who's the musician, then he suddenly kind of got into acid jazz and all funk and that sort of stuff and started exposing me to all that. And I also have a cousin from Washington, D.C., and it's 3 brothers as well, and they're sort of all the same ages as me and my brothers, and their father's Irish and emigrated over there in the 60s, and they're just like massive hip-hop heads. The middle one in particular is like a hip-hop DJ, and I remember him, they came over, I think it was 91 maybe, they came over for the summer or something, and they were in Ireland, and I remember him leaving a copy of Low End Theory by Tribe Called Quest, the CD in my house, and I never listened to it. I didn't look at it for years, and then I think about maybe when I was about 12, so maybe like a good year or two later after that, I suddenly checked it out and I was like, oh, right, okay, what is that? And then, you know, fast forward to, I guess, maybe 94, 95, I'm maybe, 14, 15 years old. And one of my friends in my sort of friendship group was a little bit older, and he DJed and he had decks, and he would sort of play a bit of everything. He liked play jungle, but he would also play like house and techno and just generally in the 90s, you know, all that sort of you know, super popular dance music like Orbital and The Orb and Left Field and Chemical Brothers and all that. He was sort of a, you know, multi-genre kind of bedroom DJ, I guess. And I just remember him playing, pretty sure it was a Dillinger track, Amen, with Amen Breaks in it. And I was just like, what is that? And I just was like, make me a tape of just all of that for an hour. And yeah, that was me basically. And then he was upgrading to Technics turntables, and I bought his old turntables. I didn't like instantly go, I definitely want to be a DJ and I definitely want to do that. I just really liked the music, and I started actually buying sort of CD compilation albums and stuff before I ever bought decks. And then I think it was Christmas or something, and he's like, I'm getting 1210s. So I was just like, okay, well, like, I'll buy your old setup, which was horrific and bad. But I bought that, and then, yeah, just started buying records. I think one of my first record shopping days, I bought Metalheads, I think, 4 and Metalheads 5. I think that's J-Magic, Your Sound, and Dillinger, The Angels Fell. So I think I bought those two on my first outing. And yeah, just like really quickly sort of got heavily, heavily into it, and was spending all my time and money in record shops and bunking off school, because I'd know when the promos landed, you know, at 11 a.m. on a Thursday. So I'd leave school, go down there in my school uniform, trying to get the like one or two copies of a promo of something really hot tune, even though I had nowhere to play it. I didn't even have a radio or nothing. I was just a kid. And then, yeah, I just sort of got really into it. I got to know some of the guys who were obviously much older than me at that time, who were running the record shops and the pirate radio stations and the nightclubs and stuff. And yeah, just sort of got given a shot on a radio show by Rohan, the Bassbin founder. And yeah, he was like, oh, okay, you're pretty good. So then booked me to play support for Ed Rush in 1998. So I just turned 18 and just started university. And then fast forward a year or so on from that, and we had our first track signed. So it all happened like really quickly and sort of quite naturally and organically, and a lot of lucky sort of moments that sort of changed the direction of my life, I guess.
Yeah, but it's funny because you mentioned luck a few times there. But there's that famous quote that, like, what is it? Luck is when preparation meets opportunity. And so it's not like things just happened to you. It's like, obviously you were working hard and connecting with a lot of people, and then things happen, like.
yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, I mean, you know, you do make your own luck. I do believe that. But I don't think there's any harm in being sort of thankful for fortunate circumstances that you were able to take advantage of. Because there's, for every one of me, you know, there's thousands of other people who have probably every bit as much talent as me, but just never got those. Or maybe they, you know, their personality wasn't the right one to be able to even identify those opportunities or to really go after them and concentrate on it. And like, I spent all of my sort of, you know, 18, 19, 20, 21, like all of those years, I was in a studio all the time, like every minute of the day. I rented a studio, and like, I actually dropped out of university and got a job to pay for the studio, and I shared a studio space with Bassbin recordings. And like every night, you know, all my friends would be out partying and, oh, come down to this place and, like, you know, let's get fucked up and, like, you know, have a good time, and I just, you know, I did that sometimes, obviously, but you know, more times I would be like, nah, I'm gonna stay here and try and figure out how the hell, you know, such and such made this break sound like that. Well, this is the thing, is we were doing this in complete isolation. We had no one to ask any questions, whether they be technical or creative or whatever. It's not like nowadays where you can go, okay, I'm going to go buy a laptop for 200 quid, download a load of illegal software, spend a day on YouTube watching all the best producers in drum and bass telling you exactly how to do everything. Yeah. And then by the end of the next day, you've made a tune. Like, this was, you're talking like weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks just to try and make one song. Like, no recall. So every time you leave the studio, if somebody else is coming in after you, you've lost all of your settings. You can never get them back. Oh, even if you, you used to photograph the mixing desk and the compressors and everything. But even still, even if you reset everything, for some reason,
it wouldn't sound the same. Yeah.
No, never sounds exactly the same. So that meant then that if you're writing a tune, you're going in and you might not come out for like 32 hours because you have to get it finished. Like, you have to have a recording at the end of it, or you're going to lose that vibe, basically. So that in itself created a urgency and a sort of a jeopardy to it that just isn't there now, where it's just like, you know, you can just piss about and I can open some project I started 12 years ago and it's exactly as I left it. Like, everything's exactly the same as long as I have the right plugins installed and stuff. But so if it was very difficult to try and figure all this stuff out, and not having the advantage of, say, someone, a Londoner who was in the same position, who you can go start hanging out and getting to know people who already know how to do this thing and learn from them. We didn't have that. Like, we just had to literally trial and error everything and figure stuff out on the fly, which was extremely painful and difficult experience. But we managed to do it well enough that we got tracks signed to the labels of our heroes. So, in a way, you know, there's another phrase. What is it like? You know, nothing easy was ever worth having, or something along those lines. Yeah. Like, you know, and that it was really hard fought and cost an absolute fortune. Like, to put a studio together, it would be three or four of us pooling all of the money we could possibly scrape together just to buy the most basics of equipment. So all these barriers to it made it like a huge kind of commitment. Like, your whole life has to be about this, or it's a waste of everything. It's a waste of time and resources. Whereas now you can dabble, you can buy the software for a couple hundred quid or whatever, and that's it. And you can be like, oh, this isn't for me. Oh, well, I spent 200 quid. Like, well, we spent thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds just to try and be able to make a beat. So it's very, very different ecosystem.
It's funny, it really echoes exactly my last discussion with Malinky Sonny. And he said pretty much the same thing. He's been like in the game, so to speak, for a long time. And he said like learning to DJ and learning to produce was like really hard for him. Like, by his own admission, he said he was like not a natural. But you add all the barriers that you talk about and no YouTube and not know all of that, made it really, really hard for him to like learn. But he also said it made it so much more valuable when he achieved certain milestones. And yeah, like the, as you said, like the effort he put into it makes it all that more rewarding. Do you think there's like something lost like today with that?
I mean, yes, I do. I think in some ways, the fact that there is no barrier to entry, there's no, literally anybody now could, you know, feasibly, if they have a laptop or a computer in their house, they can download software, probably find it for free, download a load of plugins, troll YouTube for a bunch of tutorials, literally like apps, copy the exact settings and the tutorials and so on, and you're making something that sounds pretty passable like within a week. Whereas it would take you that long just to figure out how to turn on one of these machines, let alone like do anything with it. So I mean, you know, look, I don't want to sound like an old, you know, an old fart complaining, oh, our kids these days have it so easy, and you know, it was so tough for us back then. But there is something, there's a sort of a truism of sort of human nature, is that like if someone's just handed to you on a plate or it's very, very easy to acquire, it doesn't hold as much value as something that's incredibly difficult to, you know, it's like, basically it's like, you know, it's always been incredibly difficult and rare and unlikely that you're going to become a professional football player.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's still true today.
Yeah.
It was as difficult and unlikely that you're going to become a successful like music producer in the 90s or any time before that. Whereas now it's completely different. The playing field's completely changed, and anyone can get involved. And, you know, one thing that maybe bothers me a little bit, and it's sort of a drum and bass, quite specific to drum and bass, like disease, is the absolute obsession with production technique over creativity and over actual feeling in the music and actual soul, actual funk, actual...
Okay, what do you mean by that?
So drum and bass is essentially an arms race about who has the best sounding tune. Not who has the best song and who wrote the catchiest thing or whatever, or who's like got the most soul or the most funk or the most this and that. It's about who can make the thing sound better than everybody else. That's what makes a drum and bass person a star. Like, and part of that is because the music is in a way so restrictive. It's formula means that you really don't have a lot of room to get really creative in, if you like. Like, it's a very limited structure.
A lot of codes, like, and
Well, basically, because of the it's all then to do with the lack of space and lack of headroom. So basically, in any other music, you've got all this space in between each beat, right? In between the doof, you've got loads of space, and you can do all sorts of different time signature stuff and all sorts of different grooves within any tempo, except for 170, 174, whatever. That, for me, anything other than the sort of, you know, the various patterns that we all know, there's like four or something, you know, so you've got like boom, k, boom, k, or boom, k, boom, k, or boom, k, boom, k,
or boom, boom, k.
Yeah, or like boom, boom, k, k, k. But basically, even those more slightly more jungly patterns, like if you go over, you know, doing that even at 174, it's sort of struggling, like, do you know what I mean? It's trying to fit too much in. So that means you're stripped back and you have, you know, really kind of two groove options, basically. You've got the snares on two and four, or you've got the other one. And yeah, I think that's sort of, that in itself means like, and coupled with the fact that drum and bass is the most difficult music to make sound good.
Okay, that's an interesting take.
Like, it is, though. It's a fact, right? Okay. Any mastering engineer, any mixing engineer will tell you the same thing. It's the most difficult music to make sound loud and good because there is so much competition for frequencies and there is no space in between anything. Full noise all the time. So in hip hop or in house or in any other music, you've got all of this space in between each drum hit. That you can play with, and you can sonically play with it as well as like rhythmically and stuff. And, you know, drum and bass doesn't have that. So to get a drum and bass tune sounding good and loud and fat and all that is one of the most difficult things you can try and do in music, full stop. It's been programmed music, definitely, anyway. And that is the factor that leads to this, it being this, what I call arms race music, where basically the competition isn't who can come up with the funkiest riff or the best hook or the sickest groove. It's about whose tunes demolish everybody else's tunes when they're played on a loud sound system. That's kind of always been that way too. Well, it's been that way as long as I've been involved, you know, like Dillinger was the king when I was first getting involved, because his tunes were fucking audibly louder and smashed harder than everybody else's music. So everyone was like, you know, you're trying to get up to that level. And then, you know, people like Noisia, Pendulum, and those guys come in and like completely change the sonic palette, if you like, of drum and bass. And, I love Noisia. I love what those guys do. I think they are super creative, innovative dudes and super important figures in the history of the music and moved it forward, and really incredible sonic sculptures. And Yeah, but at the same time, the amount of, all you've got to do is listen to drum and bass promos. You know, if you're on any promo mailing lists, basically almost every tune sounds the same. There's very few people where you're like, that's that guy. From the first kick and snare, I'm like, I know who that is. That's that guy. You know, and that's, that used to be more prevalent back when there was, you know, it's also down to software and hardware. Like, so hardware, you know, no two people would have the same studio setup.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
now almost everybody has the same software, same plugins, the same set of plugins and the same synths and all that. So back in the day, all the permutations of, you know, one guy might use EBU samplers with a Behringer mixing desk. Another guy might use an Akai sampler with a Mackie mixing desk. And then you've got all the other outboard bits of equipment as well that can all be varying and different. And all of that combines to give a unique sound to that person. It's why a Fotech record from the 90s sounds like nobody else, and a Dillinger record sounds like nobody else, and a Doc Scott record sounds, and so on. And you, I think a little bit of that is lost with software, and just the very fact that you're exporting a file, you're not recording a signal.
Yeah.
You're exporting a digital file. That's a fundamentally different process from recording a signal into, you know, a recording device. That's just completely different thing. And the result is different. And I'm not saying I want to go back to the old way or anything like that. And I'm also not saying there isn't loads of innovation and creativity and really sick drum and bass that gets made. And you know, all those things are still true. But I do miss the sort of the absolute individuality of how it used to be when it was all hardware setups.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like, obviously technology enables a lot of new things, but that doesn't mean we can't complain to some extent, like, about what's lost. And
but it's
true.
I mean, look, there's ups and downs, positives and negatives of both eras. You know, there is also this kind of constant temptation of, you know, the music of my youth is superior to the music of every other generation. You know what I mean? There's that every generation has that feeling. Like, you know what I mean? The current 30-year-old thinks 2010 dubstep was the pinnacle of, you know, music and can never be beaten and da-da-da-da-da. You know, whereas I would look back to the 90s and go, right, 90s hip-hop, jungle, drum and bass, UK garage, all these things appeared in the 90s and haven't been bettered since, you know? And I sort of still stand by that. I mean, there's drum and bass music from, you know, even, you know, look, listen to Goldie's album or any Dillinger tune from the 90s and like, tell me something that's happened since that's better. Like, show, you know, play me something that's better than that, because there isn't much, you know?
Yeah.
There isn't much.
Just on Noisia, because you mentioned them, have you heard the Sleepnet album or EP?
Yeah, I got sent that, I think. Recently. Yeah, some far out stuff there. Some really interesting stuff.
That's the, like, the positive aspect, I think, of like a lot of, as you said, music sounding the same, is that when something is so different and like pushing boundaries, it jumps out even more. And like when I listened to that album, I was like, okay, wow, I haven't really heard anything quite like it before. I thought it was really interesting. And again, it's like super loud. But
I agree. There's not, I'm not discounting or not like denying the fact that there have been plenty of innovations and important progressions within drum and bass since the 90s. Of course there has. And I don't know, I don't think this is a specific to drum and bass thing, but what I've noticed is, and it's not specific, I think it's just creativity or music in general. What tends to happen is, like, someone, most likely someone who's completely isolated from the scene or whatever, makes music at that tempo. It doesn't sound like anything at all you've ever heard before. Comes out, everyone's like, ah, it's amazing. And then suddenly you got 2, 3, 4 years of everybody trying to sound like that. And there's, you know, various markers in the history of drum and bass where it's like, okay, you know, obvious ones, Obstacle and Matrix in the late 90s come along with this completely new, completely revolutionary sound, like completely different from the ethos of drum and bass and jungle that preceded it, really, where it was much more a techno approach to making music, where essentially the drums stay the same the whole way through, but for a few edits and fills, and the bass and everything else is what's morphing and moving throughout the track. Whereas jungle, the bass is like a three note sub, whatever, and the beats are constantly changing.
Yeah, yeah, chopped up and throughout.
So, like, that was a complete revolution, and I'm a huge fan of that moment in drum and bass, of both of those guys. And then you have years and years and years of everybody trying to sound like that and do that thing. And then, you know, Calibre and Mark Syntax come along, and they've got suddenly music and soul and samples and, you know, funk and stuff is back in the music for the first time since pre-optical era. And that changes things. And then you've loads of people trying to ape that and do that. And then, you know, D-Bridge and Instrumental and those guys come along with autonomic stuff in the late 2010s. And then suddenly loads of people are doing that. And then most recent obvious example, Benny L. makes a tune with a big wah in it. Yeah. And suddenly you've got 4 years of wah in every tune. You know what I mean? And, you know, to a degree, it's a natural thing. Like, you know what I mean? It's... we all influence each other, and that is a natural thing, and I'm not denigrating it completely, but it is an interesting thing to observe, is like, you know, someone genuinely creative or you know, comes along with something that is genuinely different and unique, which either was they were doing because they don't care and they just want to make what they want to make, or maybe they're not even involved in the sort of active scene, they're not going to clubs, they're not hunting this music down, they know the rules of the music, the tempo and stuff, but they're just making something that's their own, and then that becomes popular, and then suddenly that's now a sort of legitimate, like, style of drum and bass or whatever. So
there's almost, it's something I've in past episodes, like, talking to producers and, like, asking them like just what they listen to, and a lot of them tell me, like, they don't even listen to drum and bass.
I never listen to drum and bass.
Okay, so that's interesting. Like, there's definitely almost value of, like, not listening to the genre you make. Otherwise,
absolutely. I would recommend that to any person who wants to make any kind of music. You know, once you're very, very familiar with the rules of the music, like, you know, the tempo and the sort of techniques you need to employ to make it sound like that music, you should then limit as much as you can how much exposure you get to that music, because otherwise you'll just make derivative copycat stuff. And what drew me into why I loved jungle and drum and bass when I first heard it as a teenager in the mid-90s was it was everything. It was just a format where you could make any style of jungle or drum and bass tune. There could be ambient, there could be reggae, there could be hip hop, there could be jazz, there could be anything, folk, rock, African music. Like, there's just millions of different influences. And it's a new format where you can take source ideas and sounds and stuff from anywhere and turn it into drum and bass. And that was what was magic about it for me. So I was like, oh shit, that's that same sample that Pete Rock used on that tune. And that's, you know, even if it's not specifically the same samples, it's like, that's the same ethic. Like, Lemon D and Dillinger clearly had like a sort of hip hop, reggae, R&B sort of influence. And, you know, that's the kind of music I was into before I found drum and bass. So it's like, oh wow, this is like a weird, like, danceable version of that, that makes you want to go absolutely crazy, but still has all that same texture and same feeling and same soul and funk and all as hip hop and so on. So yeah, I learned that very early on when I started making music. Was, and look, I was that guy when I was a teenager in the 90s, I was like, anything that's not drum and bass is just get it out of my face. You know, in terms of other dance musics like techno and house and all that UK garage, I was like, that's all nonsense. Drum and bass is the only thing.
I love garage.
And then I started writing. Yeah, I absolutely love it now. But at the time, it was an existential threat to drum and bass, because it stole the whole fire from drum and bass. And, you know, it's a really important moment. It's also when, in that evolution, drum and bass became much, much more monocultural. Mm. So it went from being really diverse, people from all backgrounds and all races involved in making it and going to you know, raves and consuming it in general, to it becoming essentially a very, very predominantly white and middle class. Mm. And that's a big problem.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
don't like that yeah, at yeah. all. And I miss what attracted me about it was its complete diversity of every type of age, of race, of gender, of ethnic background, all those things. Everybody was involved because it's London. It's yeah. London's a melting pot. London is like, you know, I call it children of empire, you know. Britain spent hundreds of years going around, you know, conquering the world, and all these people mm. followed you back home and had babies with each other, and those kids are who invented drum and bass,
yeah,
drum
yeah, yeah.
And then garage and then dubstep and da da da. So yeah, but I was a very real purist, and then I started writing the music. I realized really quickly, I was like, right, I need to expand my I need to learn about other musics. Like, I need to know, because otherwise, how do you know where to go and find source stuff from? I was never ever going to be a producer who wanted to play everything in.
Mm,
yeah. I want to make drum and bass like it's hip hop.
Yep.
At the wrong speed.
Yeah,
sample based, basically, yeah. which is what it kind of it was originally. Was literally Fabio and Groove Rider and those guys playing records at the wrong speed, playing them at 45 when they should be playing at 33.
Yeah,
and that's sort of the very genesis of the whole music. So, yeah, and then, you know, lucky you have my brother and my dad and lots of other people around me who have really diverse musical interests and knowledge. And and then you know, once you start making it and you're DJing all the time and stuff, I mean, fair play to anyone who does that every week and then, you know, sits down and what, like, listens to drum and bass. I don't yeah. really get it. Like, I mean, like, it's like, you know, I don't know, if you run a coffee shop and you serve coffee all day, what are you going to go home and have coffee?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? It's, you know, for me, it's, and for me, it is very much largely music to be played on extreme volumes
yeah.
in venues with lots of people going crazy in the late at night or during the day, but but that's what it's for. Like, it's for partying, it's yeah, for yeah. making people go off. There's plenty of stuff that gets made that's sort of like listening stuff, or maybe not stuff you necessarily play in a club, and I don't want that to go away or anything, and it has its place, but this is dance music.
Yeah, yeah.
It's music for dancing to. Why am I going to put on Andy C's latest mix when I'm chilling at home with my girl? What, you know?
Like, yeah.
Oh, just drinking your tea. Dinner. Let's listen to this, like fucking Benny Elsa. You know, so it's a dual thing for me. It's like, I don't want to be overly influenced by what other people are doing, but also more generally, I won't be bringing anything valuable or new to the table if I'm not, you know, casting my net as wide as possible. And I still do it all the time. I'm always trying to learn about new genres of music, and I spend a lot of time digging, like virtual crate digging, basically,
yeah.
looking for the most obscure, unfound sources as I can, you know, which is difficult, obviously, because everyone's got the same tools at their fingertips. Yeah. And, you know, it does make it more difficult. But if you work hard enough at it, there's an endless ocean yeah. of music out there that you don't know about. So
yeah.
That's for me as a sample based producer, that's like the absolute cornerstone of making music to me is finding fresh source material. Generally it's not fresh, generally it's old music, but
yeah.
fresh to me. I mean,
yeah, yeah, for sure. So I imagine you don't use Splice that much.
I don't have Splice. I don't really, I have a very stripped down production setup. I used to use Cubase back in the day when I had samplers and stuff, and I decided to stick with Cubase when I switched to everything being in the computer. And I have a very, very old software called SoundForge,
mm-hmm.
which is like a sample editor. Basically, it's just for sort of pre-production, really,
okay.
on sound. So, you know, you record a whole side of a vinyl in there, you could chop it all up into little useful bits and save them in a folder rather than dragging an hour of like thing into your
yeah,
project
yeah.
and trying to find bits. So Yeah, and my process has not changed since I sort of first figured it out. I'm almost always going to start a track with a sample inspiring me. So I will, you know, and it's not always necessarily like, that sounds cool, I just need to loop that and that's drum and bass tune. That can happen. But it's more, what happens after a while is you become, you're not hearing what it is, you're hearing what it could become.
Okay, yeah.
So I can listen to something now. It's great illustration of this is when I first started trying to make tunes, I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to every single person I know and steal their entire CD collection and rip every CD and every record they have. I'll record all of them and look for, you know, bits of material that's useful that I could turn in, you know, into instruments or whatever. And I remember it was the first thing I hit was my brother's acid jazz collection of CDs, and I ripped them. And I remember one album, I ripped it and I found like 3 or 4 samples on it, right? Mm-hmm. Fast forward maybe 6 or 7 years later, I've now, you know, released loads and loads of records and I'm, you know, sort of established producer. I found that CD again and I went through it again. I found like 60 samples on it. Because I'm now not hearing, oh yeah, that's obviously clean and I can just take it and loop it. And it's, you know, now I'm hearing what I'm able to turn it into source material into. So you now are listening to what's not there, basically.
Yeah.
Is the best way to describe it. And and it's a thing I try to do as well, like you know, because it doesn't stop, you know, you're always learning and getting new ideas and stumbling across new techniques and, you know, revisiting old stuff you sampled can be really useful.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's funny, yeah, going back and finding like 5 times as many samples as the first time you went through the record.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure you'll, you know, anyone else who's a sample based producer will tell you the same thing. Your mind has to be opened to what something can become rather than what it is. That's still how I operate these days.
Just conscious of time because you've been super generous already, and I know you're a busy man.
No worries.
So I just wanted to just close off with one topic. And it's just because I don't have very often people who have been this long active in the scene, so to speak. And so when that happens, I'm always really curious as to like what kind of keeps you going. Like after all these years, what keeps you motivated with drum and bass specifically, DJing? Like, like have you never gotten sick of it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think you'll find most people who are like lifers have a sort of a love-hate thing with it. I'm not, hate's a bit strong, but there's been plenty of times over the years where I wouldn't say fallen out of love with it, but where I've definitely sort of like had enough of it and stepped away for a little while. But ultimately it's like being a junglist is like a disease. Like you can't, it's like you have this now forever. There's no getting rid of it. You know, lots of people might, I would say graduate onto other forms of music as they get a bit older and stuff. And look, if I hadn't become, an artist within the drum and bass scene, I'm sure I would have left it behind in my life as a fan. I would have probably stopped listening to it in my mid-20s and moved on to other musics I'm now interested in and left drum and bass behind because it wouldn't really have any context in my life. But because I've sort of been part of it and to use a millennial term, a content creator since 2000 or whatever, ultimately I love it. It's got a unique energy that no other music that's ever existed can ever compete with. There is nothing quite like, you know, seeing a whole big mass of people all reacting in an instant to like a tune dropping or something. Like there's no music that has that reaction for me. It has an amazing way of being both aggressive and friendly at the same time. And the energy it sort of is harnessing is often like dark energy or like panicky almost, or you know, the feelings it's instilling in you are not necessarily, like, if you wrote them down on paper, good,
positive
or whatever. but it's energy, and it somehow is positive. It somehow has a positive, you know, filtration through people, like through the dance floor and listeners and so on. And I just think it's, look, for me, it's like, it's just a bug. You just can't get rid of it. Like, you've got this thing and you can't stop.
It's not a choice.
You know? Yeah. I mean, I've just, myself and Beta 2 have just, we're literally just wrapping up an album we've done for Goldie for his other label called Fallen Tree, which is his other label that he started for non-drum and bass.
Is that Searchlight? Or
Searchlight, yeah. Okay, yeah. So, we're called Searchlight, which is me and him, effectively. And we're, you know, sort of modeling ourselves, if you like, on Four Hero, who you know, were pretty much invented jungle and drum and bass and stuff, and then moved on to, you know, I don't know what you would call it, cosmic jazz stuff or whatever you want to define it as. We've always loved that. It's always been a huge influence on us. Back at the time when we started, they were in that transition and they were releasing their seminal Two Pages album, and that was a huge influence on us. And we always said, oh man, we'd love to be able to do that one day, where you're working with live musicians and it's all you know, quote unquote real music,
or organic, quote unquote.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, I don't mean that as a slight on drum and bass, but I call music that isn't dance music real music. I mean that, obviously, you know, tongue in cheek. But yeah, so we're literally just wrapping that up, and that's been some of the most satisfying and like rewarding thing I've done, basically, in music so far. It's just been brilliant, and all of the considerations you have to have when you're trying to make drum and bass tunes that are going to be successful or going to be played by people, you want all of the opposite things to be the case with this. So my main worry with it is, what I don't want is anybody to hear it and go, that sounds like a drum and bass guy's made that. Because for me, that's like the absolute biggest cuss you can give this music, basically. It's you know, and it's a big problem that there's all these things you have to do to make a drum and bass tune sound good that are like severe production techniques, basically, like super extreme, you know, manipulation of sound, basically. And that just becomes ingrained in you. You're like, well, the snare has to do this, and it has to be this bright, and it has to be this loud, and da 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 da. And you just, it becomes ingrained in you. So when you go to make other music, you have to consciously not bring that with you. And it's very difficult.
Like, unlearn it, basically.
Yeah. You have to be super conscious of it and unproduce it rather than overproduce it, which is what drum and bass is, essentially, you know, produced to death music. So, for me, the biggest sort of diss would be someone listening to the Searchlight album and going, oh, that's really clearly some drum and bass guys who made some other stuff. So I'm pretty confident we've avoided that.
Okay.
That pitfall, and hopefully we'll be able to start getting some of this music out in the world pretty soon. But the album's definitely going to come out this year.
Okay.
So we're just literally finishing the last track now, and then it'll be sent off for mastering. So that for me is like super exciting, and it's like I feel like a kid again in some way, because it's like, right, we're a new artist, we're stepping into a scene that we don't have very many contacts in, we have no audience that already knows us or anything like that. So it very much feels like 20 years ago,
starting
out in drum and bass, and we're trying to establish ourselves in that. It's like, okay, now we're trying to establish ourselves in this world of, I guess, jazz, I guess, vaguely, and soul and whatever you want to call it. But like, yeah, real music played by people, rather than some pale guy in a dark room with a computer, like noodling away on his own. So that's been amazing. But at the same time, I've also made loads of drum and bass in the last year, most of which is, all of which is signed up and, you know, will be released, I guess, over the course of the next year. And I, yeah, really cannot wait to get out there and start playing drum and bass, all this new stuff to crowds again. And yeah, it just can't happen soon enough.
No, basically. For sure. Yeah, definitely looking forward to your new tracks and your new project, definitely, as well. I know what I'm going to tweet once it's out. It's just, it sounds like drum and bass, but no, messing aside, I'm really looking forward.
Well, I know where you live now. So.
really looking forward to it. And yeah, again, like, just thanks for coming on this podcast, man. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, my pleasure, man. It's a good chat.
Yeah, really enjoyed this. I think people are really going to enjoy your like insights and thoughts and a bit of a flashback down memory lane. That's going to be really interesting. So yeah, before we shut off, maybe just let people know where they can reach out to you if they want to, and any upcoming projects that you can disclose, maybe, if you want to.
Sure. Okay. So yeah, I'm on all the usual socials, at 0TDNB is I think the handle, on definitely on Twitter and Instagram anyway. You know, you can find me on Facebook if you ever go there anymore, which I don't know why anyone would, but, and yeah, in terms of releases, I can't tell you exactly in terms of dates and stuff, but what I have locked in, and I've already sort of announced, if you like, is the CIA and the Dispatch ones are already out. There's an EP for Sofa Sound for DLR's label. Any follow-up, me and Steve are doing another release for Integral. I have two tracks on the Metalheads 25 album, an original track and a remix of an old Beta 2 track. What else is there? A North Quarter EP. I've finished the North Quarter EP as well. So I have another 6 or 7 track EP, which I'm super, super happy with. I think the last EP was one of my strongest releases ever, maybe. And I think this is better than that. So.
Okay.
I'm really excited about that. And what else is there? Loads of remixes that I couldn't even start going through, but there'll be a regular trickle of stuff. And yeah, just keep an eye on the socials for release dates and so on.
Definitely looking forward to that Steo collab, because those are some of my favorite tracks of yours. And North Quarter stuff is always really top-notch releases, so really looking forward to that EP as well.
Brilliant.
But cool, man. Yeah, again, thanks for your time. Really enjoyed this one. And
my pleasure.
All the best in London.
Yeah, nice one, man.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.